Good afternoon and welcome to Open Air, KLW's weekly magazine of most things culturally considered. I'm your host, David LaTulipe. This week, a good deal of theater on the program and some great music. I'll be talking with Jonathan Spector, artistic director of the Just Theater, and playwright Robert Handel. Rob's play The Maze is one of two works that are in repertory at Live Oak in Berkeley through August 4th. Also on the theater front, actor-writer-clowns Sarah Moore and Michael Phyllis will be here to talk about Wonder World, a new take on the Alice in Wonderland theme in which an 80-year-old Alice revisits the rabbit hole and Mad Hatter, among other characters. Also this hour, Judy Tsang, the director of programming for the Stern Grove Festival, shares some details about that August, well, actually June, July, and August institution, which this Sunday features music by the Kronos Quartet and a couple of other local groups. Plus, I'll talk with conductor Teddy Abrams, who returns to his native Bay Area next week to conduct several concerts with the San Francisco Symphony. It's Summer Arts in the City. Stay tuned. Just Theater will share two plays for its summer 2013 summer season with mysteries at their heart. They'll be in repertory at the Live Oak Theater July 12th through August 4th, Underneath the Lintel by Glenn Berger and A Maze by Rob Handel. I'm joined by Jonathan Spector, artistic director of Just Theater, who joins me in studio, and by phone by one of the playwrights, Rob Handel, who wrote the aforementioned A Maze. Welcome to you both.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Well, Jonathan, let's start with a little bit of the background of Just Theater.
Sure. The company has been around since 2006, and we produce plays, generally new plays, that are smart, funny, and strange.
All good things?
We look for plays that are highly theatrical, that use a theatrical imagination to look at morally complex questions. We've been, both of these plays have plays that we've been interested in doing for a while, and then had the opportunity to do them together, and that's been a really exciting
challenge. Has Live Oak always been your performance venue, or have there been other places?
No, we're a nomadic company. We're based in the East Bay. We've performed at the Berkeley City Club and at Ashby Stage, and this is our first time at Live Oak, but we're hoping to be able to continue to be there for a while. The theater has just been taken over by Theater First, and they've been doing a lot of upgrades to the space, and we're the first company to be in there since they've been managing it, and we're very excited to be launching it under its new regime.
Very nice. How did you first come across Rob's work?
I believe I'd been aware of Rob of his work for some time. I used to live in New York, and I think we'd had a lot of mutual friends in that sort of downtown theater world. But this play specifically was recommended to me by a playwright named Anne Washburn, whose work we've produced in the past. And she had sent this to me and said that she thought this would be something that we would be interested in. And it was. And we'd been initially talking about producing it a couple of years ago. And for a bunch of various logistical reasons, it's taken us until now to be able to do it.
Well, Rob Handel, who we have by phone, is a founding member of the Playwrights Collective 13P, which has won 4 Obie Awards, and currently heads the dramatic writing program at Carnegie Mellon University, where he joins us now from his office. Rob, now the title of your work has a deliberate space between the article and noun, A Maze. Why don't you tell us a little bit about the play and the play on words or perception, maybe, that A Maze will have for people?
Oh, thanks. Gosh, well, I mean, I don't know. The play on words is sort of unintentional in some ways, because I feel like really I just wanted to identify that the play is a maze as well as a play. The audience kind of has to find its way through it, and it contains dead ends and places where you have to go back and go a different way, and those same kind of, you're sort of having the same experience as the characters in trying to find the heart of the mystery that everyone is circling around. And so I think of it as more of a descriptor than a pun.
Okay, can you give us a little full description of what we're going to see on stage then?
Oh, sure. Well, the play moves rapidly in time and space between three groups of characters, or possibly four. And there's a comic book artist who has been working on a comic book novel of extraordinary length, which has taken him his whole life, and it is nearing the completion of his project. There's a little girl who has spent most of her youth being held captive in a basement, and we see her after she has escaped from that. And there are also a couple of rock stars who are having crises in their artistic life, and all their stories are intertwined, as one comes to learn.
I take it that the story of the girls in the basement happened post Cleveland or pre Cleveland?
Oh, that's a really good question, and I'm both fascinated and slightly freaked out to see what will happen in a post Cleveland environment with this play. I mean, tragically, there are always cases like this. I worked on this play for years. The origins of it are probably 5 or maybe 6 years old now. I wrote it during a very complicated time in my life where I both was becoming a father and moving to Pittsburgh for this job and all sorts of things. And so it was a very long and fragmented and wonderful development process. Way back when I first had the idea, most of the specific details of the abduction in this play are taken from the case in Austria some years back, where when the young lady finally escaped as a teenager after a decade or so in this basement, she had a whole plan for how she wanted to be publicized. Like, she picked out the TV news figure that she wanted to interview her, and she figured out the whole process because she was familiar with TV and radio. That was her link to the outside world. So I was very fascinated by that detail, and that was sort of the center and the starting point of where this story comes from. So it's very pre-Cleveland, but I'll be interested to see what happens.
Indeed. Now, speaking of your background, now, are there particular authors or playwrights, either contemporary or classic, that have had a particular influence on you and that we might hear, although in your own voice?
Oh, that's an interesting question. I don't know. I think that this particular play, I feel like, is actually influenced by the filmmaker Adam Egoyan and his early films, which have in common with this something that I always wanted to imitate in one of my own works, a kind of Whirlpool-like quality where you start out seeing a bunch of different groups of characters and not knowing how they're related. And it sort of whirlpools down to a kind of common trauma that they all share. And that's very much the way the first third of this play works.
Mm-hmm. Now, this is being directed by Molly Aronson-Gelb. Now, Molly is the founder and co-artistic director of Just Theater. You're in Pittsburgh, I believe. So what sort of input, if any, are you having on this production?
Oh, we've talked on the phone, and it was very easy because Molly's understanding of the play was really everything one could possibly want. Everything she said about the play, I completely agreed with, and I was very excited to speak to her, and I can't wait to see what the production is like. I haven't been to the Bay Area for rehearsals, but I will be coming in to see the show soon, and I'm really excited about it.
Well, I wish you a smooth trip out here, and I hope it meets your expectations.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm also just wanted to say that I'm enormously flattered, and I love the idea of the play being done in repertory with Underneath the Lintel, which is one of my favorite plays, and Glenn has been helpful to me in my career, and I'm very excited about that.
Well, we're going to speak a little bit more with Jonathan next about the other play, but I want to let you go, and I wish you a safe flight out here, and enjoy the Bay Area when you come see your own play in
so
repertory
much.
Here.
Thank you.
Thanks, Rob. That's Rob Handel. His play, A Maze, is part of the summer repertory of Just Theater. Back now with Jonathan Spector, who's the artistic director. Jonathan, tell us about the second play in the production, Glenn Berger's Underneath the Lintel.
So Underneath the Lintel is a one-person play about a Dutch librarian who finds a library book returned 119 years overdue. and starts to become obsessed with the person who checked out this book and the person who returned it, and follows a series of clues that take him around the world and uncover a sort of existential mystery that goes to sort of the heart of creation as his life sort of spins out of control on this quest. And it's, I think it's that idea obsession that sort of resonated between these two plays, of that librarian's obsession, along with the rock stars and the comic books and the person who kidnapped that girl, that they're both both very much plays about sort of the rabbit holes of obsession we can go down.
Okay. Well, we haven't talked about the actors that are involved in these productions. How were they selected and how are they doing?
They're doing fabulously. For Underneath the Lintel, which is a one-person play, it's being performed by Mick Mize, who's a member of our company and who's an actor who just, when we had initially talked about doing this play a couple of years ago, it was the person we had in mind. And he just got back from being on tour for a year with the Cirque du Soleil. And so was once again back in town and available to do this play. And the Amaze is a large cast. I believe it's the largest cast show that we've done. It's got 8 actors, who are, Harold Pierce, Sarah Moser, Franny Morrison, Lasse Christensen, Clive Worsley, Janice DeLucia, Carl Hovick Thomas, and Lauren Spencer. And it's a wonderful, exciting cast. Eight actors playing, I believe it's 17 or 18 roles amongst them. There's a lot of moving pieces in that play, and it's a lot of fun.
Well, it sounds like an interesting combination of plays for this summer repertory at Just Theater.
Yes, I'm really excited. And the other thing to mention is that one of our values is making theater available and accessible to everyone. And so all tickets to all performances of the shows are pay what you can at the door. So we encourage everyone to come check them out.
Well, thanks for taking a little time to talk with us about them today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Sure. It's Jonathan Spector. He is a director and co-artistic director, founder of the Just Theater, these productions of Amaze by Rob Handel and Underneath the Lintel by Glenn Berger run through August 4th. Information and tickets are available at justtheater.org. That's theater with an E-R, justtheater.org. My guest, Judy Tsang, is the director of programming at Stern Grove Festival, the nonprofit organization dedicated to producing an admission-free performing arts concert series here in San Francisco, Sunday afternoons, now through August 18th. She has sat on panels for the San Francisco Arts Commission and the National Endowment for the Arts, among other groups, and is a San Francisco native, UC Berkeley grad. Welcome to KLW, Judy.
Thank you.
Now, as a San Francisco native, you must have been well familiar with Stern Grove before you took up the mantle of director of programming.
Yeah. Born and raised, actually, in Chinatown. My parents immigrated here, and growing up, you know, we were always trying to look for free things to do as a family. And I think we must have read in the paper that this was happening at Stern Grove. And I remember going up and, you know, sitting up in the trees listening to the San Francisco Symphony as a kid.
Mm-hmm. Now, these concerts have been going on since 1938. Now, you've been acting as a director of programming for about 12 years now. There must be a sense of carrying on a tremendous sense of history here for you.
Well, actually, I think I've been director of programming for about the past 6 years.
Oh, okay.
I started off as an intern. I love the festival. Always wanted to be involved in it. We have been doing this for 76 years now, and it will continue.
A major renovation of the Grove happened in 2005. Now, it's always been, of course, a beautiful setting, but those renovations really transformed the space. I'm wondering how it affected the perception of Stern Grove.
Well, being around for so long, the Grove was kind of through some wear and tear, and in 2005 went through this major renovation, a brand new stage, some new dressing rooms in the back there, and the concert meadow itself. There's some new terracing and stonework, beautiful stonework.
It really is something, Dan.
Yeah, it's a gorgeous space, and that hasn't changed at all. It really kind of kept in with the natural beauty of the place.
So now it's not only more comfortable for the guests coming to hear it, but it's more comfortable for the artists coming in.
Most
new
definitely,
backstage.
Yes.
The festival started off with a grand picnic back on June 16th to the music of Boz Scaggs and Michael McDonald. The San Francisco Symphony just played this past weekend, and the San Francisco Opera finishes things off on August 18th. There's a lot happening in between those grand dates. Now, how is that balance struck as a programmer, and share with us a little bit about the booking process for guests.
Yeah, it's about finding that right balance. We want to be able to present a little bit of everything. There's such great diversity in the city that we want to bring that same diversity to the Grove and have a program that reflects that. So we do a little bit of everything. One week you'll have the San Francisco Ballet. The next week we'll have a hip-hop show, and then an Indian brass band. So we're all over the place, but that's what's so great about Stern Grove Festival.
And it's interesting, too, that some of those audiences overlap. It's not like it's just the symphony crowd that comes for the symphony. They'll come for the Indian music. They'll come for the group from Brooklyn as well.
Yeah, I love the cross-pollination of audiences. And oftentimes, people come out and see the one artist that they know and are familiar with, and it's just a way for them to get introduced to the festival. And once they're there, they'll see what else is in the season, and they'll try to come out to other things, and that's what I love. It's a real great chance for discovery, because all our concerts are admission-free. There's a really great opportunity for that.
Well, let's say there's someone, I can't imagine, but you know, on the radio, you never know. Someone has never been to Stern Grove. Hard to believe. But let's say I'm of a Stern Grove virgin. How do I come to Stern Grove on Sunday? What time should I arrive? What should I bring with me?
Well, it's first come, first serve. So the earlier you get there, the better the seat you get. And you, as you know, in San Francisco, the weather is changing all the time. So make sure you bring, you know, some layers, pack a picnic, bring a blanket, and just make an entire day out of it. That's the best way to enjoy Stern Grove Festival.
I understand there's also a picnic table lottery that happens.
Yes, we do have a couple of picnic tables. They're for all our supporters, board of directors, volunteers, members, and it's really a way for us to bring people in and get to know who we are a bit more. And there is a chance to have a couple of those seats at those picnic tables.
How does that work?
There's an online system where you enter for a chance to win some seats.
So at sterngrove.org, you may enter your name and contact information, and you might be one of the lucky ones to get an actual picnic table at Stern Grove.
Yeah.
Fantastic. Now, this Sunday, the amazing Kronos Quartet is going to be featured with the San Francisco-based Real Vocal Quartet starting things off, with local indie electronica group Geographer with Magic Magic Quartet. Now, the Kronos last appearance was at the Grove back in 1998, and this is their 40th year anniversary. So this is quite an event that's going to be happening with them on Sunday. I'm wondering if you could share some of that programming that they're bringing.
Yeah. About a year ago, I got together with their manager, Janet Cowperthwaite, and we talked about just what we can do in celebration of their 40th anniversary at Stern Grove, and we wanted to put our stamp on it, make it a bit special. So at the same time, I was speaking with a colleague of mine over at Lincoln Center Out of Doors, Bill Bragan, over there. And we thought, why don't we commission a new piece of music, bring in Amon Tobin, who is a DJ and electronic musician, and have him commission or have us commission, co-commission a piece of music for Kronos Quartet.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
David Harrington, longtime player, violinist with this, the Kronos Quartet, is involved in this and has always considered San Francisco one of the best places to play. So I'm sure he's going to have a good time on Sunday.
Certainly, yeah.
A few of these arrangements, I should give a little shout out to an associate by way of birth here at KLW. Leah Garchik is often on our panel called Minds Over Matter, and her son Jacob is doing some of these arrangements that are going to be done on Sunday.
Yes, they do work with a number of artists internationally known and locally known, and Jacob is definitely one of them.
Mm-hmm. And tell us a little bit about the Real String Quartet, or the Real Vocal String Quartet. How does that work?
They are an amazing group of four women who not only perform and play, but also sing as well. So they'll be starting off the concert on Sunday.
Mm-hmm. And the Geographer?
Geographer is also another local band. They're an indie rock group with a number of electronic elements to their music. But for this Stern Grove Festival appearance, they're going to strip it down and do an all-acoustic set with Magic Magic Quartet on stage with them. So it'll be quite special.
So that starts things off for the first half of the program. You'll hear the Real Vocal String Quartet and then Geographer with Magic Magic Quartet. Brief intermission, and then we have the Kronos end of things, which includes always some really interesting music. And I understand that one of those pieces is going to be done subsequently in New York as part of a festival.
Yes, that is the Amon Tobin piece that we're co-commissioning, and we are going to be having the world premiere in Stern Grove Festival, and then it's going to be going over to Lincoln Center after us, so East Coast, West Coast premiere.
Very nice. Now, there's always something for everyone at Stern Grove. I encourage people to go to sterngrove.org, not only to learn about the programming, but perhaps to get a picnic table for this coming Sundays or one of the subsequent Sundays at Stern Grove Festival. Beautiful space, those sculpted lawn areas and the stonework. It really is something if you haven't been there. Judy, I want to thank you for taking just a little brief time to talk and share your experience with Stern Grove, and I wish you a successful 77th year. I'm sure planning's already underway.
Yes, planning is underway.
Judy Tsang is the Director of Programming at Stern Grove Festival. More information at sterngrove.org. We're going to hear some music of the Kronos Quartet that you'll hear this coming Sunday now. This is music of Kronos Quartet here on Open Air. You'll hear it this Sunday at Stern Grove. That's music performed and arranged by the Kronos Quartet, Clint Mansell's Death is the Road to Awe from his work The Fountain, and is the concluding work on this Sunday's Sterngrove concert, which, in addition to the Kronos Quartet, will feature the local, real, vocal string quartet and the indie electronica group Geographer with the Magic Magic Quartet. For full information, visit sterngrove.org, and by all means, visit Sterngrove if you can before this season's festival concludes on August 18th. I'm David LaTulipe, and you're listening to Open Air here on KALW. Still to come this hour, a chat with conductor Teddy Abrams, who will be conducting several San Francisco Symphony concerts next week. But first, continuing this week's parade of acting and writing talent, I'm pleased to welcome actors Sarah Moore and Michael Phyllis, who are also co-writers of a new take on the Alice in Wonderland theme, where an 80-year-old Alice returns down the rabbit hole for another adventure. It's a presentation of the Children's Creativity Museum, Thrill Ride Mechanics, and Deborah Mosk Productions, and it's called Wonder World, playing weekends beginning this Saturday through August 11th at the Creativity Theater at 4th and Howard here in the city. Both Sarah and Michael are no strangers to the Bay Area theater scene. Sarah's critically acclaimed one-woman show, Show Ho, has had two successful runs at San Francisco's New Conservatory Theater Center and Theater Rhino, and continues to tour around the country. And no less than the late, great Merv Griffin called Sarah the hardest working clown in show business. I last saw Michael Phyllis at the New Conservatory in his one-man show called D-Face that he wrote and starred in a couple years back, one of several shows he's been doing, where he's also starring and writing. He's currently the resident playwriting instructor at the New Conservatory, award-winning actor, playwright, solo performer, and educator, a proud alumnus of the San Francisco Circus Center's Clown Conservatory. Welcome, Michael.
Welcome.
And welcome, Sarah.
Thanks
welcome.
For having us.
Yeah.
Of course. Now, you're both co-writers of the show called Wonderworld. That's Wonderworld with a U, W-U-N-D-E-R, world. Tell me how this whole concept started.
Well, I think it was probably my mother. And we talk about this, cause actually, she just called us on the way here in the car, you know, just to check and see how is the show going. But I am, you know, the product of a really incredible, courageous British mom. And, you know, I grew up, you know, hearing this woman constantly telling me to get out there and adventure and be adventurous. And that's what she did when she first came to this country. She was only 19 years old when she got here. And, you know, I sort of have followed her lead. So the character of Alice, you know, I wanted to sort of do a different take on this, as you said. And it is. And it's based really on my mom. It's based on this adventurous, crazed, fabulous, you know, English lady who, you know, is not really afraid of anything. Mm-hmm. So that's my role model. Yeah.
And going back to the story as it ages is your journey down the rabbit hole again.
That's right.
So, Michael, how were you? Are you helping Sarah along with the concept? You're both billed as co-writers, but I have to tell people it's being billed as a world premiere human cartoon, a pantomime with music and without language. So just what were you guys writing? It sounds like false advertising to me.
Well, you really should see the script. It's very interesting. It's got a lot of language in it and pictures and sound effects and music. What we did was an action script. So, and we talked about the show months and months ago. We did a workshop of it at the Garage Theater in San Francisco in February. And before that, we got together and Sarah had brought the concept, and we both talked about what would happen to these characters, these colorful Wonderworld characters, and Alice herself, you know, if she was 8 in the original story, then now, you know, times 10, how have things changed in her life and in Wonderworld? And what can this story be about? If Lewis Carroll's original was about adolescence and growing up, then what is this Alice? What's her journey about? And then we looked at what each of the characters brought in the original, and we thought about the different things that we wanted to talk about regarding age and not just growing up, but growing old and finding that joy again, finding that youthful place. And we thought that that's what's in the Wonder World. And then getting to it was something that we've been workshopping ever since then, and with our fabulous cast and directors.
And we're, you know, he and Michael and I call each other, you know, clown sister and clown brother, because, you know, my background is also circus clowning, and we're both actors and we've both been writers. And it's really fantastic to work with somebody who, you know, no matter who, we both throw incredible ideas on the table and then we just merge them. And we end up coming up with this really, really solid, these solid action scripts, which is why we call ourselves Thrill Ride Mechanics. Mm-hmm. We feel like, you know, we're fixing the thrill ride of the world by doing by creating these stories in this new format of human cartooning. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But also, I just wanted to say, we also call the show, you know, Alice in Wonderland for the Mick Jagger set. Because, you know, here's this generation of that is going forward, and they're continuing, you know, to perform and be vital at 70.
And their,
you know,
concept of Alice in Wonderland is more Tim Burton than anything original by Disney, or, you know, more modernized version of Alice anyway.
Right, yeah. Right. Yeah, I mean, Alice in this version is Mick Jagger's age, but she's not touring as much. But you know,
she still has the lips, though. That's what counts.
And she's very steampunk. She's like a steampunk granny. You know, she's got the goggles on her head, and she, like, you know, she actually heads, you know, down the rabbit hole through a steamer trunk and comes up into sort of a magic airport. Mm-hmm. And so you see her actually have to go through the TSA as well, which is an idea that Michael and I were talking about for a while. Like, isn't it hysterical? I mean, how much comedy is there, really,
if you think about it? Do they bump into Edward Snowden there?
No. Oh, see, there's another idea.
Yeah, we were already working on it before he did his whole thing.
Rewrite.
So, yeah, maybe next time. Wonderworld 2.
Okay. Yeah. Well, you two are in the show. What other characters are in the show?
Well, Sarah plays Alice, and I play, among other parts, the White Rabbit. So, you know, our tagline is, you know, how age and maturity have affected Alice and her friends. Is the rabbit still late? Is the Hatter still mad? Will Alice make it back to the retirement villa in time or lose her head in the process? So, playing the rabbit, we took that concept of, is he still late and what is he late for? And how does that translate into his character and what he brings? But basically that relationship is old friends. You know, if they were really, the rabbit is what started Alice down this whole adventure to begin with. And now they've reunited in this cast and in this story. But we also have, you know, we picked like the big five iconic Wonderland characters. So we have, in addition to the White Rabbit, we have the Cheshire Cat, who is maybe one of the younger characters in the show, being that he has 9 lives, you know. So he can still move, you know, around in ways that we can't quite. Mad Hatter.
I see sequels coming here.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I know. We could keep going. The Looking Glass, you know. We have the Mad Hatter. We have the Caterpillar. And we have the Red Queen. And with those 5 characters in addition to Alice, the whole story is created by those folks.
So did you go, you must have gone back to the original Lewis Carroll story, but did you go and reread it, or are you just using some of the concepts and characters from it?
We did both.
Character development.
Yeah, because you read it, and then I just listen to what she said.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You like that. It's got to be a great relationship. Sarah.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly. And there's so many versions. You know, it's a public domain thing, you know, that he did. So for it, that's why there are so many versions, I think. And you know, we just really wanted to hit the, you know, the archetypes, the really, really important characters that lead her, that teach Alice something new in this new phase of her life as she becomes more mature, as she gets older. And our cast is incredible. I mean, we have Joan Mankin, who really is like a Bay Area treasure. Mm-hmm. You know, she's one of the greatest actors I've ever seen or known. She's the reason I'm in California. Mm-hmm. You know, she brought me here to join Make a Circus back in 99. And now it's like here we are working together side by side. She also plays Alice's sister, who in the book is sort of waiting for her at the rabbit hole. So she also plays that character as well as the Mad Hatter. And then we have Rory Davis, who is an incredible young choreographer, dancer, who plays the cat. And Dawn Smith, who also has been in the circus with Joan and I and done clown work. And she's the Red Queen. So it's pretty hot bunch of physical comedians.
I guess so. I need to give a shout out here to Andrew Nance, who's
yes!
the director, whose terrific work, not only as a director but an actor, has been seen here in the Bay Area often. Now, what's Andrew bringing to the production?
Precision.
Yes.
Oh, my gosh. Precision like you wouldn't believe.
Because you get a bunch of clowns in a room. And...
Oh, boy.
Oh, yeah. And something that doesn't have words in it, there's a lot of room for imagination and for play. And Andrew is so great at that and also reining us in. You know, that. What did you say?
Hosing us down.
That's right. No, yeah. That's director for clowns just has a giant fire hose.
Got a ruler.
Yeah.
Yeah,
slap the wrist.
Yeah, well, in his, I think that he'd agree that he always wants to know why. Every single thing that is done on stage, he wants to know the reasons, whether it's this kind of show or any kind of show.
Very smart.
The intentions behind it, and they have to be active intentions. So in that sense, he's really helped guide the story in that there's no wasted moment in Wonderworld, that even though there aren't any words, we feel like the story is very clear. And you can follow Alice's journey while it also leaves room for imagination. You know, that we're not giving you every single part. There may not be physical appearance of some props and sets, but you'll understand it. And especially kids, I think, are really ready to imagine, you know, something right in front of them. But it's been interesting to see how the adults react to it, too, and how they come out and they've actually told us, I feel like a kid again.
You know? Nice.
Yeah, they're using their imaginations to see the show, and we're using imagination to present it. And, you know, it's the opposite of an iPad. An iPad gives you everything you need. It's right there. There's nothing. It's all presented for you. Mm-hmm. In this case, it's a very kinetic experience. It's live theater. It's human cartooning. We are human cartoons. And we're bringing to you, you know, something that is, you know, fully original and not, you know, in a way, because it's like a silent movie. It's like a silent movie with great music under it, fully pantomimed. So it's just, I think it's a wonderful experience for kids of all ages. You know, I mean, I think everyone will get something out of this, just like the old Looney Tunes cartoons. There was something for the grown-ups and something for the kids and everybody else.
Right. Right. Well, you mentioned your background in clowning and training as clowns. I know that's hard work, but why is it that mimes and clowns always get such a bad rap in the theater world?
Do they? I hadn't heard that.
It's because it's behind your back.
Yeah, that's what it is. No. Well, you know. Well, I think the classic sort of bozo, Ringling Brothers, red nose, pie in the face type of thing is very frightening to a lot of people. And that's why reclaiming that, the new American clowning, is something that the Pickle Family Circus, the Big Apple Circus,
right, yeah,
and now Thrill Ride Mechanics, you know, and people like Joan Mankin, Peggy Ford, Paley Lacy. There's many people in the Bay Area who are responsible for the resurgence of new American circus and clowning in particular.
Well, tell me then, what is the difference between clowning, proper clowning, and just over-the-top physical acting, then?
Not that much, especially not in the European sense, because, you know, honestly, you know, what's the old saying? That real clowns get their red noses from crying and drinking, you know? No, but seriously, in the European sense, a clown is simply, you know, is human animation. This is a person who has turned themselves inside out and given us themselves in completely high relief. Mm. And Henry Miller, I think, said, you know, clowns are poet. A clown is a poet in action. Mm-hmm. And so that's the approach that we take. And that's why we're using the term human cartoon as opposed to clown, because that's where that is real clowning. Mm-hmm. You are a human cartoon. That's what you are.
And in some ways, with some of the really successful clowning I've seen, both in school for clowning and just in general as an audience member, I think that some people can be put off by that idea of somebody coming into the playing space and demanding laughter and trying to be so over the top that it's hilarious. And I think that the most successful clowning, and what you're going to see in Wonderworld, is the clowning that draws you in, that isn't over your head, over the top and in your face and so bombastic, but it's really there's a sense of vulnerability to it that shows you the real human, and that's where those deep laughs and the emotion can come from when you're watching something as an audience member, when you connect to the human, not just to the red nose.
Mm-hmm. Well, I wish this radio interview was visible to all of our listeners, because Sarah has one of the most expressive faces I've ever seen. And,
right,
well, Michael's just adorable.
Yeah, he
Thank
is.
You.
Thank you both for spending some time
with
us today.
Thanks
for having us.
I wish you a terrific run.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Is the Hatter still mad? Is the Rabbit still late? And just how is Alice holding up after all these years? You can find out by catching Wonderworld. Details at wonderworld.net. That's WUNDERworld, wonderworld.net for this run. It's written by Sarah Moore and Michael Phyllis, directed by Andrew Nance, and runs Saturdays and Sundays through August 11th. Conductor Teddy Abrams could be described as the classical equivalent of a triple threat. But instead of the acting version, which is singing, dancing, and acting, he is a pianist, clarinetist, and conductor. And it is in that final capacity that he returns to the Bay Area this month to conduct the San Francisco Symphony for several concerts. And he joins me now by phone from near Seattle at the Olympic Music Festival, where he's playing some chamber music. Teddy, welcome to Open Air.
Great to be here.
So let's talk a little bit about your Bay Area background. You went to the San Francisco Symphony, is that correct? The San Francisco Conservatory.
Yes, actually. I was born and raised in the Bay Area. I've lived all over, pretty much every sector of the Bay Area, in fact. And this is the area that I got my musical start in. I've been connected to groups like the San Francisco Symphony and the San Francisco Symphony Youth Orchestra and the Conservatory of Music since I was a little kid, basically. And this is where I was inspired to become a professional musician, where I was inspired to be a conductor. And I think it has one of the great musical cultures, of course, throughout the entire world. And yes, I did go to the San Francisco Conservatory of Music on a kind of circuitous educational path that I took. It was kind of a weird path where I ended up kind of diverting when I was about to go into what would have been middle school. Instead of continuing kind of a traditional path, I ended up going to a community college for a long time and really devoting a lot of time to music in addition to that and working in the San Francisco Symphony Youth Orchestra as a clarinet player and eventually made my way up to the San Francisco Conservatory where I studied piano with Paul Hirsch until I was 18 years old and then had my bachelor's at that kind of unusual period.
So what drew you to Curtis?
Yes, I did go to the Curtis Institute of Music right after that, which is a very, very small music school in Philadelphia. And it's kind of famous for being sort of like the Hogwarts, I would say, of the music world.
Okay.
Kind of secretive, very small school, and it's been well known as one of the most difficult schools to get into, and so my hopes were not that high for being able to get in because the acceptance rate hovers around 3%.
It is a very, very prestigious institution, that's for sure.
Yeah, exactly. And so I was very, very pleasantly surprised to be accepted as a conductor. And of course, with that weird educational path that I took, I was quite young to be a conductor at Curtis because most conductors are generally older. They're in their mid-20s, even late-20s, in fact, when they're really doing their full studies as a conductor.
Right. You mentioned
Catch 22. You're just like, well, you need to have certain conducting skills to even get into a college. On the other hand, the reverse is true too. How can you actually become a conductor if you've never really conducted before? So fortunately, I had a lot of support when I was in my teens from Michael Tolson Thomas, who of course is the music director of the San Francisco Symphony, and he worked a lot with me on conducting, bringing me out to the New World Symphony in Miami, which is a training orchestra that he started there. And so I did have enough kind of background and experience as a conductor that I was able to kind of make my way at a relatively early age. So
right.
Curtis was an amazing experience because you really are surrounded by the best musicians.
Well, you mentioned it was the Hogwarts of music schools. Does that mean you entered on a Quidditch scholarship or something? Or?
Well, everybody is on a full scholarship there, actually, which is one of the really attractive components of the school. It's been that way for a very, very, very long time. And the school is very small. It has about 160 students, and so pretty much every single person is on a specific fellowship. There's enough fellowships to go around for just the number of students that are there. So everybody goes for free, and all of your expenses are paid for if you need that, too. So it's purely based on merit. And so you get people from many, many different backgrounds and from all over the world. And these people go on to incredible things. They do extraordinary musical work in the profession later on. But just as importantly, they're doing incredible musical work at school. So you're just as inspired by your teachers and the people that you're working with who are kind of professors as you are the actual students.
Right. Now, let's talk a little bit about the fact that you're in near Seattle now in this chamber music festival. You're working with clarinet and piano at the festival?
Yeah, I'm actually playing both clarinet and piano, and that's something that I try and continue to do so that I don't kind of limit myself to one thing musically. I mean, of course, conducting is challenging enough and time-consuming enough, But I find that kind of keeping a very well-rounded musical background is extremely beneficial to all of the different components of what I do. So I find that playing chamber music or improvising on the piano or conducting, they all kind of balance each other out and play off of each other and help keep things, I think, kind of in check and actually inform each other. And also composing is a major component of that. And I think the model for this is really based on a lot of the kind of great towering figures of our musical past, the people that we hold up as kind of musical gods, so to speak. Of course, people like Mozart and Beethoven, but even people moving into the 20th century like Mahler and Ian Stravinsky and Copland. All these people composed and played and they also conducted. And I think that, that having that kind of versatility for me is very, very beneficial to keeping kind of the inspiration going.
And you mentioned MTT as a mentor, a fine pianist as well. I imagine that a lot of the score study you must have done with him must have been at the keyboard.
Yeah, well, absolutely, yeah. I think that when you're learning music as a conductor, you have to also approach it from kind of a multi-faceted, different angles, because you can't simply look at a musical score in any one way. I think that you have to be able to conceive of it entirely within your brain, actually. You need to be able to hear every single part that's going on and imagine it, you know, the way that you would like to hear it, the way it would like to be expressed. You have to be able to do that completely away from an orchestra or away from a piano. But on the other hand, being able to feel the actual kind of visceral, physical approach to a musical score, being able to play, say, a Beethoven symphony at the piano, is also a really excellent way to get in touch with the flow of a piece from beginning to end, the kind of sweeping arc of a musical composition. I think that's also very beneficial, too. So you're always looking at it from different perspectives. And, of course, singing different parts of it to yourself is an important part. And then, of course, the entire rehearsal technique, which you can't actually entirely prepare for, because that's like more of a sports game almost, where once the ball is in play, I mean, you have to react to what's actually going on in real time.
Sure. Now, let's talk briefly about these programs that you're doing with the San Francisco Symphony. It's ambitious. You're conducting four programs in this the month of July on the 18th, the 19th, 20th, and 21st. All different programs, a couple of common denominators there. Copland's Rodeo makes its appearance on a couple of those. But a lot of repertoire in this. Is some of this new repertoire for you, or is this old hat? I mean, you're a fairly young conductor. Where are you finding the time to learn new scores if these are new to you?
Well, actually, most of the music I've conducted before, fortunately. And I guess sort of along the way between being at Curtis and then studying at the Aspen Music Festival and then with my job that I had at the New World Symphony and then a few other orchestras since then, including the Detroit Symphony where I am right now, I've picked up a few pieces, which is really beneficial because studying a score takes a long time. I mean, it's not something that you can kind of cram and do very quickly, and it really helps when you have gone through music in advance, especially when you're working in a high-pressure situation like this summer series with the San Francisco Symphony. Things are coming at you right away. I mean, there are four programs in 1 week, so it's a lot of music, and you have to be completely aware of all the possibilities of what might occur in orchestral situations.
Sure.
There's no time to kind of stop and talk through every phrase. That just doesn't happen in this kind of situation. So,
right.
Yeah, I've actually worked on most of this music before, which is, again, very helpful in these kind of pressure situations.
Well, in addition to the four concerts, they're in three different venues. You're very familiar, I know, with Davie Symphony Hall, where the first two concerts will be on Thursday the 18th and Friday the 19th, but then you'll be performing at America's Cup Pavilion for a special concert on Saturday the 20th in a brand new space for everyone. So that'll be an interesting experience and an all Tchaikovsky program on that program.
Yes, exactly. So we have to have that kind of flexibility. But that's really fun, too, because it means we're going to be working with different audiences. Hopefully, we're going to be engaging people that haven't necessarily encountered the symphony or haven't encountered that particular repertoire before. So every opportunity, especially in new venues or new settings, is a chance to really kind of, as I say, sell the music, sell
sure.
what we're doing, show people just how extraordinary this music is, and also, of course, how extraordinary the San Francisco Symphony is. And I think that at this point, especially with the kind of, I mean, overwhelmingly brilliant work that Michael has done at the Symphony, and it's pretty well known throughout the community that the SFS is one of the great orchestras in the country and in the world. I think that that's actually an internationally recognized notion right now. But it means that we always need to be demonstrating that to the widest public possible. That's one of the reasons that I like to conduct, because it gives you that chance, that wide reach, to really show people just what kind of things are possible with music.
Sounds like a lot is on your plate as well. And that final concert is going to be in Dolores Park, always a great concert here in the summer. A wonderful crowd at Dolores Park. It'll be for Sunday, July 21st. On that program, Beethoven's Egmont Overture, some Tchaikovsky and some Copland, as well as John Williams' Overture to the Cowboys. We're going to hear Aaron Copland's Rodeo, as recorded by the San Francisco Symphony, as we say goodbye. Teddy, I wish you a great trip down from Seattle. I wish you some great chamber music while you're up there. And I wish you all the success for these concerts back in your own Bay Area.
Well, thank you so much. I can't wait to be back.
Teddy Abrams will be conducting the San Francisco Symphony over four concerts, July 18th through the 21st. Information at sfsymphony.org. The San Francisco Symphony, conducted by Michael Tilson Thomas, in that excerpt from Aaron Copland's Rodeo. You can hear the symphony perform that work in its entirety next Friday in Davies Hall, and Sunday the 21st in Dolores Park as part of varied programs conducted by Teddy Abrams. Again, information at sfsymphony.org. For the next 2 weeks, Sarah Cahill will be sitting in for me at this time. Thanks in advance to Sarah and to Neil Swinkles for helping out with those upcoming broadcasts. A reminder that you can hear any of the past broadcasts of Open Air, including this one, as it is just about past, after all, at our website, kalw.org. Look for the drop-down menu of Music and the Arts and click on Open Air. I also welcome your comments or show segment suggestions anytime. You can email me, David Latulipe, at david@kalw.org. Thanks for tuning in.